Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Well, like the other Russian oligarchs, Roman Abramovich made most of his billions when Russia handed out the commodity goodies. He got the oil, he got the aluminum, he got the plastic toys, and he got other businesses. Now, the question is how. That's not my business. It's your business. You figure it out. All I know is he has nice toys, nice houses, cars, boats, planes, wives, girlfriends, shoes. But as a rich man told me when I was a young kid, I told you the story before, pardon me, indulge me. This is for the younger people. It's not for anyone over 30. When I was 15 or 16, I told you one friend had a father who was like the tough father, club owner. Who would ever think that in that circle of guys there was a club owner? He was a club owner, a pugilist, a street fighter, a really tough guy, but everyone loved him because he was a quiet John Wayne type, never spoke loudly. He had a pair of fists on him like hams. But he was very gentle, like all tough men. He was a gentleman, you know, and in the truest sense. But he was the guy that the kids gravitated to. So when you're 13, 12, you want to know what it's like to be a man, what do you do? So he'd sit us down on Sundays. We'd go out to the house. We'd eat in the house, usually spaghetti and meatballs, whatever. And, you know, play around ping pong, get in trouble in the neighborhood, whatever. Shoot out Christmas tree lights with BB guns through the basement window. I remember once the best fun I ever had in the winter. Shooting and sticking the BB gun out. Some today you'd be arrested probably putting Sing Sing for shooting out a Christmas light. On the trees, the little lights, no one was hurt. It's innocent stuff. Kids do these things. Tom Sawyer, remember? Mark Twain. Today Mark Twain would be arrested as a childophobe or something. Or inciting violence amongst children. He wouldn't be allowed into Britain. So he would sit down and he would say to us, look, the important thing to remember about money is that the first million is the hardest. Now, that's when a million really meant something. Today, that would have very little meaning. Everyone's a millionaire. He said, the first million is the hardest. Well, I couldn't even understand what that meant. That's in an age when the minimum wage was like a buck. So you say, when the first million is the hardest, the first million, that's a lot of money. I mean, a million? The first million is the hardest. I didn't even know what that meant. But now I know what it means. He's absolutely right. The first million is the hardest. That's what he said. And then he also said that the richest men he knows, the richest men that he knew, and none of them were really rich, were all men who had lost everything several times and bounced back. And he said, guys, remember what I'm telling you, bounce back, is that you have to learn how to take the falls and come back off the mat. That was number two. And I think most importantly, he said, remember, the amount of money you have isn't important because you can only wear one suit and eat one meal at a time. Now you say, well, that's common sense today. Is that common sense today in a consumer-driven society where you're told to, you know, I don't know, own more than you can use, whatever? So you think, you can only wear one suit at a time and only eat one meal at a time. I thought that was very interesting, those words. And I used them for many, many years in my life when I didn't have much financial fortune to keep me going because there's no shame in being poor. I got to tell you something. I know some very poor people. They're very nice people. I know some poor people who are very bad people and vice versa. The poor or rich has nothing to do with a person's personality. I got to tell you that. It runs across the spectrum. But this poor guy once said to me, he said, show me in the Bible anywhere it says, thou shalt be rich. There's no requirement you should be rich. It's not a requirement that you walk around with these things in order to be a good man. If you have them and you're still a good person, good. But I remember when he said that. He said there's nothing in the Bible. Nothing in the Bible says that you have to be a rich man to be loved by God. I thought that was very interesting. Here's a guy who told me this. I don't keep in touch with him. He wasn't a particularly great guy, but he was a smart man. He had a little room in a single-room occupancy building in San Francisco, and he and I were friends for a while. And one of my most pleasant moments in my life was him cooking a sausage for me on a frying pan and a two-burner like hot plate in his room as we looked down on the streets and talked about the world. Can you imagine that? So where do you take your pleasure from? Is it the big five-star hotel? Sometimes that can be great. Me, I prefer sitting in a room like that sometimes, having a good conversation with a sausage. Not all the time anymore. I mean, I'm not into that. That level of my life is over. I don't do that anymore. It's not that I don't want to. I'm just not in that headspace. So here we are. That's it. And it's neither here nor there. I'm just chatting. It's a talk show. And remember what the word conversation means, boys and girls. It's a lost art. Conversation with verse. With verse, conversation. The object is to keep the conversation moving. And I try to speak with you, my audience of millions, as though we are in a room together and we're friendly, we're having a conversation. The object of a conversation is not to defeat the other guy and render him silent. The object of a conversation, as I learned, is to converse, to share verse with each other. So if you'd like to share verse with Michael Savage, it's easy to do. Not now it isn't, but the phone number, and you know it already, it's jammed the lines. Because every time I get softer and more reasonable, the lines go hot because people are, you know, they're not as intimidated to call the Savage Nation. You know what I'm saying? That's all. That's it. That's the whole story. I don't have to burn up the airwaves in order to have you listen. The audience is there. It goes up and down every day like everything on earth. There's nothing constant. Life is what it is. Que sera, sera. Whatever comes my way, I'll ride it. I told you that years ago. If I have a donkey, I can ride a donkey. If I have a chauffeured limo, I can get in the back of the chauffeured limo and do the telephone just as well as the next guy. I've had both. Now we'll take your calls on the Savage Nation. Tennessee, Frank, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Mike, one of the things I enjoy very much about your program is when you talk about your boyhood in New York. I'm a 70-year-old Italian-American born in Brooklyn, with a smattering of Jewish relatives, and it really brings back good memories when you speak
so
about
it. What in the world are you doing in Tennessee? Witness protection or what?
That's basically it. That's what I tell the people when they ask me.
No, with your accent, Tennessee, I mean, you know you can't get any food.
No. Italian food is really non-existent down here. Most ethnic foods really are non-existent down here.
What do you have to go to Olive Garden for Italian food?
Well, you know what? That happens.
I can imagine a guy like you going into Olive Garden and saying, "I want I can't even remember the name of it anymore. Some of the rare dishes, let's say, whatever." But Frank, you like more, let's say, stories from psychological nudity. Did you ever get a copy of the book, Frank?
No, I haven't, Mike, to tell you the truth.
I'm going to send you a free copy of Psychological Nudity. Is that your wife in the background hectoring you?
Yes, she is. She would really feel honored to say hello to you.
What's her name? I want to hear her name.
Her name is Jean.
And you guys came down there together on witness protection, or you met her down there?
No, we're in the casino industry, so we both came down here on the witness protection program.
Well, it must feel like it, even if it's not true, Frank.
Yep. I have a son out in Reno, Nevada, who's also in the gaming industry, and he's a big fan of yours, listens every night.
All realists are. Any realist in America loves this show. Even if they don't agree with me politically on some of the points, they love the show because they know it sounds like their relatives talking to them.
Well, it is. And the enjoyable part about your show, it's not all, Republicans bad.
That's right. So let's see. Of all the stories, which do you like best? Tippy dies and is thrown in a garbage truck, Fat Pack. I bet you like Fat Alan the Tuna makes the tuna.
You had a fellow on from New York one night who he just kept on telling stories, and you related to him very, very well. I can't.
Oh, Fat Al's Tuna, but I remember that. Well, look, here's the fantasy I have, Frank. My thought is that in a couple of years when Obama creates the internment camps for conservatives, I get a choice. They're going to say to me, look, Savage, we don't want to put all of you away. The hacks don't have to go because they'll switch coats as fast as I can say Barack Obama. It won't be a problem with the corned beef guy. It won't be a problem with the golfer. They'll become diehard government supporters. But with you, Savage, you don't even have to do that. We'll let you stay on the air as long as you only tell stories from New York. That's my fantasy, Frank. You think it'll happen?
I'll tell you, I wouldn't mind it. I'd still be a big fan.
Yeah, let me tell you something. It's a fantasy because these people are not nice people, Frank. You know and I know what they're all about.
And
Frank, stay on the line. I'm sending you a free copy of Fat Al's Tuna, The Electric Blue, Saddle Stitch Pants, and 72 other stories from Psychological Nudity. When I'm walking around now in San Francisco, which I do rarely, they don't know who I am because I'm in radio. But the minute they see that Gucci hat and Teddy, they come up to me. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see all your life.
There's another song on that album that they played quite a bit, Blackbird. And there's a verse in the song Blackbird about blackbirds fixing their wings, rising up and flying. So Manson told his family that by Blackbird, come on, we know what the Beatles are talking about. They're talking about the black man. And they're telling the black man to rise up against the white man.
Terrible thing. So here we are, 1969 to 2009, goes back actually to 1809. Some would say it goes back to 1409. Others would say it goes back to 09, and some would say it goes back beyond even that. What it is a class struggle. It's a struggle between those who have and those who have not. It has nothing to do with race. It has everything to do with have and have-nots. And since we are living east of Eden in the land of Nor, where there is no Eden and there is no place, we have to live with what we have and we have to have with what we live. And since we have now in the White House and around him some people that have never before been seen in such high places in America, we have to live with it, and we're trying to live with it. And so the people go out and they protest and they're called racist. They're called every name under the sun by Nancy Pelosi, by Harry Reid, and the other illegitimate, the people who don't belong in office at all, are telling the people they don't even belong to have the vote. They have no right to have the vote because they're actually doing what Obama says people should do, which is organize. Think about it. The people in the Tea Parties, the people who went out in the town hall meetings were actually community organized community. So everything that Obama says you should do, they did, only they didn't agree with him. Therefore, they were fascist, Nazis, un-American, thugs. Everything that the American people aren't, he said they are. Therefore, the government is the illegitimate, not the people. Now, you say it's anti-government, you're wrong. It's anti-illegitimate government. And I'll be darned before I stop telling you what I think is going on. I believe we've had a communist revolution in this country, and I believe it's a slow communist revolution, only you don't even know it. I know that the word socialist is being laughed at. When I first started using it years ago, no one even knew what a socialist was. 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago when I started using it, what's that? What are you talking about? Now everyone, socialist, so good. What you don't know is there's 30, 40 varieties of socialist. What's the big deal? He's a socialist. What's he hiding it for? The only question is what variety of socialist is Obama? Is it on the mild side? Is it on the British side? Is it on the middle side? Is it on the far side? Is it on the other side? And what side is it? Is it on the side of Joseph Stalin? Is it on the side of Adolf Hitler, socialist from Germany? Or is it the side of Joseph Stalin, socialist from Russia? Is it on the side of Pol Pot, the socialist from Cambodia? Or is it a mild sort of state socialism, slightly higher taxes, more government interference, more government-run things, but the people are basically left alone? What side is it? Is it Chavez closing down radio stations, imprisoning people, taking property that isn't theirs? Is it Mugabe style? We don't know, because he doesn't know, because he's only a figurehead. He has no idea where this snowball could end. See, the avalanche has started. We don't know where the avalanche ends. That's the whole point. You don't understand it. There's been an avalanche in America, only you don't know where it ends. You don't know how big an avalanche it is. The question is, who set off the dynamite? Well, you have to look at the currency, because he who controls the currency controls the people. Now, who controls the currency? Well, you have to look at the currency traders of the world. You have to look at the man who almost broke the Bank of England. You have to look at the man who almost broke the Malaysian currency. You have to look at the man who is no doubt trading in U.S. dollars to run the dollar into the toilet by betting against it while claiming to be for it, while putting an imposter in order to make sure that the people have no voice in the government. You got to look at the money trader. You got to look at the money changer in the temple, and you'll find out that if you actually look at the handprints on it, you'll see it goes all the way back to the very same evil genius who almost broke the British pound, in the humble opinion of the man who sits with a microphone and an undershirt on the second floor, watching the world go by underneath his feet. And that's the whole story. It's a talk show host, one man looking at the world, one man's opinion of no power, no importance, not heard from by ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, or Fox. Therefore, he doesn't exist, but he has an audience of millions. No one knows how. How could it be that he has an audience of millions that so fanatically listen to his every word, hang on his every word, want to hear every word, can't wait to hear every word, get up in the morning hoping he's on that day, don't want fill-ins, don't want replays. Where's the man? Where is he? Why doesn't he talk? How come he can't do it every day, all day? Why do I listen to him? What's wrong with me? He's right. I know he's right. When I first heard him, I hated him. I thought he's an extremist. Now I realize I was crazy. He was right. Now I realize the danger we're in. Hey, man, where can I buy Banned in Britain? I don't know. It's nowhere in a bookstore. Why not? How come they publish books by unknown doofus so-called conservatives and you can't find Michael Savage's books in a bookstore? I don't know. Is it some kind of conspiracy that New York publishers are in business to make money, won't touch a New York Times best-selling author? How come he's never on television? How come? All aboard Khmer Rouge. Here we come. Beware the government media complex. You have Oderman on MSNBC. You have Oderman and Softball, and on the other side of the coin, you have Leprechaun and Wallbanger. They all allegedly hate each other, but in fact, if you flip the coin, it's either side, what do you want? Throw it around four sides to the coin, because it's all one media complex. It's sort of a Rubik's Cube. The Rubik's Cube has four heads on it. Not as many heads as you would think, but there's four heads, and you think liberal, conservative, Republican, Democrat. No, my friend, Moloch owns them all. Watch out for the government media complex, because you think that the Leprechaun and the Wallbanger oppose Oderman and Softball. What you don't know is they're all flipped by the man, the peasant Avante, who controls the dice. The man who controls the dice is the man who controls the TV, the radio, the newspapers, the magazine.
Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
A brave effort. Why did it fall short?
I don't know, man. I just want to say I'm sorry to everybody, man. I really wanted to be a champion today, man. And I worked my ass off. Your daddy's a strong. He hits hard. And I never wanted to quit, man. That's never in me. I didn't want to quit. I wanted to go the full 12 rounds. I know it's me up, but hey, I'm sorry, guys.
What you're listening to on the Savage Nation is one of the most astonishing concession speeches in the history of American sports. That is the great Mexican-American fighter, Chris Arreola, 6'4", 245 pounds, after withdrawing, his team withdrew him in the 10th round of a heavyweight bout against Vitaly Klitschko, the Russian gladiator at 6'7". Who also holds a PhD in sports science. Now, the reason I'm playing this is because when I watched that fight and I saw this bruising gladiator, Chris Arreola, crying because he had to withdraw from the fight from having taken too much punishment, I had not seen anything like this since I was a kid. I've not seen fighters cry. But why was he crying? He was crying because he had shame. And the reason he had shame is because he has pride. And the reason he had pride is because he respects himself. And the reason he had shame is because he failed his audience of Mexican-American supporters in the crowd at the Staples Center when he had to withdraw in a TKO in the 10th round. And it brings me back to America today. We're living in the twilight zone of America. Why do I say that? This was once a nation that liked to win, a nation that took pride in winning, a nation that strove for victory. And we succeeded beyond the wildest dreams of all other nations precisely because we strove to be the best and would be ashamed to be anything less. And what happened to this nation? For the last 40 years, the liberals have come along and said all that was wrong. Liberals said that it was victory that held shame. Liberals taught that there was no such thing as winning or losing. Liberals wanted to preserve self-esteem above all. Instead of achieving the esteem of the world, they wanted self-esteem. And so now we have entered, as I say, the twilight zone of American agitation. We don't know whether we won or we lost in Iraq. We don't know whether we're winning or losing in Afghanistan. We don't know whether we won victory or defeat against Iran. We don't know whether we won or lost against North Korea. Now, there are some men in America, though, who still know the difference between winning and losing. In a boxing ring, there's very little compromise. I saw one of them the other night after the boxing match, Chris Areola. He had been defeated by his opponent in the 10th round. I'm talking about a man 6'4" and 245 pounds. And he was ashamed of losing. He was so ashamed he was crying in front of the whole world. Can you imagine that in the leftist America of today, being ashamed of losing? You see, Chris didn't want to give up, but his manager threw in the towel for him. In the same way that our spineless leaders have thrown in the towel for America. The left wing has told us that there are no winners or losers, but in the boxing ring, there are clearly winners or losers. At the end of the match, Chris Areola vowed that he would come back and do better next time. His loss and his shame girded him for the next fight. And that is what we must do as a nation. We must hang our heads when we lose, but we must seek triumph and seek victory and seek to win. We cannot permit the compromised political class to carry us along in this twilight zone of America. Play that clip again of Chris Areola, one of the most astonishing concession speeches I have ever heard in the history of American sports. Please play it.
Chris, a brave effort. Why did it fall short?
I don't know, man. I just want to say sorry to everybody, man. I really wanted to be a champion today, man. And I worked my ass off. The guy is a strong. He hits hard. And I never wanted to quit, man. That's never in me. I didn't want to quit. I wanted to go full 12 rounds. I know it's me up, but hey, I'm sorry, guys.
So you didn't want it to be stopped, but obviously your trainer and the referee felt that you would take too much punishment and you were not able to get to him in any way consistently.
No, I couldn't get to him, man. He couldn't find the fight he was supposed to fight. He ran what he was supposed to. I just couldn't get to him, man.
Now, no fighter of Mexican-American heritage or of Mexican heritage has ever won a heavyweight championship. Areola was determined to be the first. He came in that ring, and he fought a man who was bigger than him, stronger than him, and, frankly, more skilled than him. And when he lost, as I say, he was heartbroken, and his shame for his people and his loss was amazing. Now, I don't want to take this any, you know, much further than I've taken it, but I was moved by this, and I was moved to think about this once proud nation and how it's been brought to its knees by the compromised political class. When did it start? When did we first become compromised? Some would say, well, it goes back to Vietnam. Some would say it was the shameful withdrawal from Vietnam as a result of this, of the knife in the back from Walter Cronkite and the political, and the journalist class who said we had lost when we didn't lose. Some would say it began with Nixon. Others would say it began with Clinton and his compromised morality. Next, people would say it began with George Bush and his compromised so-called victory in Iraq, which is really a victory for the military-industrial complex. And now, of course, we have the most compromised presidency in American history with Barack Obama, who has just said, I don't even want victory in Iran, with Iran. I'm not seeking victory against Iran. Do you have that soundbite? Because you're not going to believe this. Here is
I'm not interested in victory. I'm interested in resolving. The problem is that Iran repeatedly says that it's pursuing nuclear energy only for peaceful purposes, and its actions contradict its words.
So here is a man who is the leader of the free world, the commander-in-chief, who sends troops to die for America, and now he says he's not interested in victory with Iran. He's interested in resolving the problem. Do you understand what I'm saying to you? I think maybe men could understand this better than women, and I'm not trying to pander to men or put down women, but I got to tell you, I watch too much television, I will admit. I watch nonstop television late at night. I couldn't sleep. I was so agitated from seeing what's going on with America, with Britain, with France, with Germany. I see an entire Western democratic slate falling apart, because of the compromised political vermin who are running these countries. I'm sorry to say, you think I enjoy saying it? Can you name one person running one Western nation who you look up to? I can't. It's not just Obama. Look what went on the other day. Iran sneers and spits in the face of the West and says, there is no Holocaust when everybody knows what happened. Then they say we're going to get nuclear weapons and you can't stop us. Then Time magazine gets on their hands and knees and licks his boots. Then he says to Obama, you'll regret what you just did. So in order to outsmart or outflank the Hitler of our time, Obama comes out with a speech along with Gordon Brown, the pillhead, and Sarkozy, the skirt chaser, and says, well, we knew about it all along. They didn't know anything. Our intelligence communities have failed us once again. Remember the national intelligence estimate about a year or two ago that came out and said Iran was not developing a weapon? Do you remember the big news blast across the liberal networks that we were all lying, Iran was not developing weapons? Now tell me, who was it in the National Intelligence Estimate Committee? I can name a few names. They were all over every left-wing media outlet in the world. Half of them worked for the Defense Department. The other half worked for the CIA. The other portion of them worked for another intelligence agency. And every last one of them was a yellow-bellied red commie. That's my opinion, and that's why we are a compromised nation, because we have compromised vermin rising to the top. As I was taught as a child, all you had to do was go out to a beach in a dirty city in the morning, and you'll see what floats with the incoming tide. And that's what floats to the top of the political structure.
Savage.
Why did he mean? Whatever I did, he'd find a way to counteract that. And he just found a way to win, and I'll find a way to lose.
I think you gained a lot of fans in losing here. And for giving a great effort. Thank you very much, Chris.
This ain't the largest you know me. I'm coming back.
Now, that's a heart of a man. That's a warrior. I mean, if you've seen movies like Rocky or The Harder They Fall, whatever the movie was, they were actors playing at this role. Here's a man not playing at the role of being a warrior who lost. But how often have you seen a warrior of this magnitude crying in the ring, not because he was physically hurt, because he certainly got beaten a little bit, but he wasn't as badly battered as some I've seen, but because his pride was injured more than anything. In other words, his pride is what hurts, and he was ashamed he had to quit in front of his fans. And I go back again to my principal idea here, which is that we're living in America, an America where that's in the twilight zone. We used to be a nation that won. And something happened now where we elect men and women who only know compromise, because these are the compromised people of America. They're all lawyers. 99% of these politicians are lawyers who believe in compromise and working out so-called deals. And we all walk around somewhat ashamed of being an American. We think that we stepped in something dirty. We don't know what to do with our shoes. None of us really feel pride in being an American anymore. And we keep electing these compromised critters. And look what we have now. Here is a man, Obama, who traveled around the world to apologize for everything America that never did. He went all the way to the Middle East to say, I'm sorry to these demonic figures in the Middle East. And he got down on his hands and knees. And what happened? What happened to Barack Obama? What happened to the result? What was the result of him begging for forgiveness in the Middle East? Well, what happened was a third round of testing of medium-range missiles that can hit not only Israel, Eastern Europe, and Middle Eastern nations, but several U.S. military bases as well. And Venezuela, his good friend Chavez, who embraced him in the U.N., Venezuela and the dictator of Venezuela says it's working now with Russia and Iran in finding sources of uranium to build nuclear weapons. And what about his good friends in China? China says it will display new upgraded missiles to celebrate the 60th anniversary of the founding of Red China. And what about India? India now announces that it can now make nuclear weapons up to a strength of 200 kilotons, four times over the line that the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty pledges signing nations not to cross. And this is what Barack Hussein Obama told us would never happen if he were elected. This is what Barack Hussein Obama told us would never happen when he came to power. This is the president who promised us unity and brought us nothing but disunity. This is the president who went around to apologize to the world and instead got a slapping around that nobody ever thought a president would take. And so, as I say to you, when I watch a fight between two heavyweights of this size, 6'4", 245 pounds, against Vitaly Klitschko, 6'7". Now, if you don't know who I'm talking about, Chris Areola is built like a refrigerator, like a tank. Vitaly Klitschko is older, taller, 4 inches more in his hand reach from the shoulder to the armpit to the end of his fist. But he's also built like a Greek god. He has a perfect face to go with it, and he has an earned PhD in sports science. He's a highly technical boxer, and the other guy couldn't get near him. In fact, I remember meeting Klitschko at a fight in Vegas a while ago, and he was one of the nicest gentlemen I've ever really had the honor to meet. And I asked him something about fighting, and he said to me, I said to him, "Is it how much of this is mental?" And he looked at me and he said, "It's all mental, Michael. It's all mental." You know, here's a president who's supposedly the commander-in-chief who has had unlimited time to talk to special interest groups for each of those 70 days. What does that tell you about Barack Hussein Obama's priorities? Let's hear the I want to hear the I need the in order to get the show going. There you go. Give it again. Give it again, Sam. Play some music for a minute.
You don't remember me, but I remember you. 'Twas not so long ago.
You know, I've got to give you a little, I hate to use the word lesson in what communism is, because many people are throwing the word Marxism around or socialist around, and they're right in a generic way, but they don't really understand what they're saying. And since I was the first in the media going back 15 years to start explaining to the American audience what a socialist was, and I go back to 94, long before most in the media were using the word socialist, I was explaining it. Now a lot are, because they're right, because if it walks like a Marxist, if it talks like a Marxist, it is a Marxist. So you have czars surrounding Obama who literally openly espouse communist philosophy and hold up communist murderers as heroes. Here you have White House communications czar Anita Dunn praising Mao Zedong, as I just said to you, and no one understands how dangerous this is. So let me give you a little history, about 5 seconds worth. It'll be more like 2 minutes worth. Maybe once a week I'll insert a little bit of knowledge into this discussion of what a communist is, what a socialist is, so that you can become better educated and perhaps better defend yourself against what has happened, what is happening, and what Obama wants to do to this country. And when I say what Obama wants to do to this country, I mean it very clearly. Why do I say that? Why would he appoint an overt Maoist as communications director unless he agreed with her? Unless he agreed with her philosophy and what she wants to achieve with our children? Why would there be so many czars who are anti-family, anti-church, anti-synagogue, anti-religion? Because that is the definition of what a communist is. They're masters of deceit. They are masters of deceit. You have to understand that all communists are anti-religious. No matter whether they go to church or synagogue to put on a show, doesn't matter. Bill Clinton used to carry around a big fake Bible, remember, with a big fake cross on it? Do you remember that? Remember when his friends in Hollywood gave him a bigger Bible and a bigger cross, and we joked about it in radio in 94, 95, 96? So now you got Obama, 20 years, he sits in a communist church, and now all of a sudden he's in another church. You really believe it? Well, what is a communist when it comes to religion? You have to understand that a true follower of religion, whether it be Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, Muslim, a true follower of any religion cannot embrace communism. Why? Because Marxism, Leninism is irrevocably opposed to all religious beliefs and all forms of worship, whether they be Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, or Muslim. Why do I say it? One of Lenin's basic teachings is, quote, "We must combat religion This is the ABC of all materialism and consequently of Marxism. He wrote, the Marxist must be a materialist. That is an enemy of religion. And so in theory and practice, the communists make and made no distinction among any of the world's greater religions, as you well understand. Karl Marx described Judaism as antisocial. What you don't know is that we certainly know Hitler was anti-Semitic and it led to the deaths of 6 million Jews. That we all know. We all understand that. But you didn't know that there were Marxian tirades against Judaism that were equal in, let us say, in insanity, but not in result, thank God. Karl Marx himself described Judaism as antisocial. He described it as an expression of Jewish egoism. I can guarantee you that if you scratch the skin, and if you get under the skin of any leftist that you know, any supporter of Obama who says that he's not anti-Jewish, he's just anti-Israel, you will find that he believes in the same exact manner as Karl Marx did, that Jews and Israelis, Zionists, whatever you want to call it, are antisocial and egotistical. Why do I watch boxing? Because it's there. There it is. No, most of us can't box. Every man dreams of defending himself. Is there a man who watches a boxing match that does not psychologically wish to God he was not the winner in that ring? So he figures he's going to watch and he's going to pick up pointers. The real world isn't like that. By the time you figure out what to do, you're on the ground already. So that's why you don't confuse yourself with the boxer you're watching in the ring. And it's the same thing with talk radio. You like listen to this game that I'm involved in here called talk radio. It seems like a natural thing because I flow like an athlete. Try taking the lariat and rotating the lariat beneath you while you're talking to an audience of millions, and you'll see what I'm talking about.
Savage.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Every poll that comes out shows that the majority of Americans in every state are conservative. How is it that we have liberals in Congress? Could it be that you've been lied to, that the vote today is about as valid as that of Uruguay, that everything's been skewed by scales, that they've used illegal aliens and false computer programs to put Obama in office and to keep skells like, I'm using the word a lot today, like Feinstein and Boxer in office forever? Nobody likes Boxer and Feinstein except illegal aliens and others. How is it that the mainstream American doesn't have a representative other than a few in the Southeast? And here and there a smattering here and there. How's it possible? Answer, the government media complex. At case in point, National Public Radio. An organization that would not survive were it not for federal dollars. Of course, none of them have the capacity to make it a commercial radio. And they're on the wrong side of history with regard to everything, including nutrition. Case in point, they have a guy on who is talking about the glories of Jewish delicatessens and glorifying poison food. We all know the food is poison. Now listen to this. Here's a guy they have on NPR. Instead of talking about the wisdom of alternative medicine, the wisdom of nutritional supplements, the wisdom of herbal medicine, the wisdom of self-care, the wisdom of controlling yourself with regard to eating poison. The slobs on NPR have a guy on talking about the beauty of Jewish delicatessens and how they're an example of culture. Listen to clip five.
Legend has it, because this happened 2 years before I was born, that my grandfather had been treated for angina, and he was supposedly released from the hospital with a stern warning from the doctor saying, you know, you really have to live better, you can't smoke, you can't eat these fatty foods. And so to celebrate his release, he went to Schwartz's Delicatessen in Montreal, a famous delicatessen, and he got a sandwich piled high, a smoked meat sandwich piled high with speck, which they no longer make, which was the fat cut from the top of the brisket, the pickled fat, dusted in paprika, and then grilled and then re-sliced. So it was a sandwich essentially of pure fat, and he died about a day or two later. I mean, the sandwich did him in, but he died in a mustard-soaked blaze of glory. It ain't health food, but it's not poison either.
It is poison. It is poison. It's pure poison wrapped in orange cellophane. And the fact of the matter is, for NPR to promote this shows you that they're on the wrong side of virtually everything. You know, I was thinking about this the other night. I was thinking about how many years I was a pioneer in the field of popularizing nutritional supplements, nutritional medicine, herbal medicine. And many of you own my books going back to 1972. My first published book was Earth Medicine, Earth Foods, Nutrition Against Aging, Maximum Immunity, which Houghton Mifflin published in 1986, and it has been in like six languages. Many people don't know that. And I realized something. Just as I was trying to awaken America to the limited view of the AMA medicine, the philosophy of the AMA doctors, this doesn't mean that they're corrupt, and it doesn't mean that they're evil. It's just that they have a very two-dimensional view of medicine. And so for many years, there was a growing awareness of this, and the alternative medical movement began. And as a result, there's been a revolution in self-care with regard to people cutting down on various foods and taking in other foods and using supplements wisely. And I'm responsible for a great deal of that, and I'm very proud of it. But the very same mindset that I brought to educating America with regard to the dangers of certain foods and the benefits of certain supplements, I have tried to bring for the last 15 years to the political discourse. In other words, Democrats and Republicans may not be evil any more than AMA doctors are evil, but they're all trapped in a limited doxy. Their viewpoints are limited, and the limitations are such that anyone who falls outside of the doxy of the AMA is called a quack, and anyone who falls outside the doxy of Republican Democrat is called, well, whatever you want to call whatever the name is, doesn't matter to me. But in fact, the very same revolutionary, if you want to use that concept, of not eating speck, not eating fat, not eating schmaltz, exercising, eating a lot of vegetables and fruits, that was considered quackery in the 1960s and 70s by the AMA doctors, many of whom, of course, themselves have come to understand that that's nonsense to call people who are in the nutritional field nuts. You have to have both lines of medicine operating at the same time, both the preventive and the Western lines of medicine. No one's arguing against surgery or medicine per se. They'd be fools to say so. But you can't exclude the values of vitamin C, vitamin E, the B vitamins. I go down the list. I'm not going to give you a whole encyclopedia right now. I've written about it for so many years. But it's the same with the political structure. If you're going to sit there and listen to a schmuck on the radio who tells you Democrats bad, Republicans good, Huckabee's great, Schmuckabee's even better, Palin is terrific. If you're going to listen to that, you're not getting anywhere. It's the same exact thing as the AMA either selling you A or B, column A or column B. And if you really want a change in America towards a real, whole, wholesome America, an America that is pure again, an America that is somewhat natural again, an America that has pride again, an America that has dignity again, a body politic that can shake off the disease of decadence again, then you're going to have to rid yourself of the addiction of Democrat-Republican. Applause, please, because I know I deserve it. I deserve it from that little speech I just gave it to you. The very same mindset that I and many other pioneers brought to this nation going back, and there were people way before me, I can name many of them. It started long before I arrived on the scene. Some of the pioneers, I've forgotten myself, but they're around. They're older than I am. I inherited some of their genius and ran with it and wrote some great books that millions of Americans bought over the years. And then I entered the world of politics on the radio in 94, quite by chance, because I'd gotten so angry at what I had seen going on, the Democrat-Republican game, and I started talking about real policies and their real effects on real people. And here I am today, borders, language, culture is my message. It's no different than my message about stop eating fat. Stop eating speck. Start eating carrots. Start eating green peas. Start taking massive doses of vitamin E as the Shoot brothers tried to educate the people from Canada in the 1950s. They're still way ahead of everybody. They proved back in the 1950s that 800 to 1,000 units of vitamin E a day would probably prevent most heart attacks. Now, of course, there's been a concerted effort on the part of the pharmaceutical industry and doctors to prove the Shute brothers wrong, but they're not wrong. They're not wrong any more than Dr. McCulley was at Harvard in 1954 when he discovered that if you gave rats a certain diet and you denied them certain B vitamins such as B6, they rapidly developed hardening of the arteries. If, on the other hand, you gave the rabbits vitamin B6 pyridoxine, you could prevent the onset of atherosclerosis. McCulley was a genius. He was a pathologist, way beyond the shills that you see in the media today. And their studies have never been talked about to any great extent. I remember writing about this in 1983, I think, in Nutrition Against Aging. I don't even remember anymore. Most of these books are out of print. They should be reprinted. And maybe I'll do so. I mean, I did reprint Healing Children Naturally, and that book is selling like crazy because there's really not a better book about raising children from the point of view of diet and vitamins. And again, I'm not here to sell you a book. I'm here to sell you on the knowledge, the concept, the philosophy of rational medicine, which includes diet and nutrition. Same with politics. Again, it's the same exact thing with politics. What we have with guys like Newt Gingrich, with guys like Dick Armey, who, by the way, called for the fairness doctrine, if I remember correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, what they are the equivalent of the HIV virus inside the body politic of the conservative movement. What they do is they actually attack the defense cells that arise to fight the radical, let us say, liberals inside our blood system, if you want to use that analogy. Guys like Dick Armey mimic our defense cells by attacking them, invading them, destroying them, and then walk around inside the macrophage camouflage like Trojan horses. I'll be right back.
Savage.
If I were to say to you, has your child been taught who Galileo was, or Amerigo Vespucci, or Dante Alighieri, or Leonardo da Vinci, or Giuseppe Verdi, or Antonio Vivaldi? Do they know who Enrico Fermi was? The answer would be no, because the communists have so infected our schools that they have now made Columbus not only not a hero, but a villain. The vermin who are now in the National Education Association, the communists who are writing the textbooks, have now turned him into a criminal. They have criminalized all of the white European heroes of our time and turned them into the enemies. Now, it is true, of course, that horrors were induced upon the Native Americans upon the arrival of the conquistadors. There's no question about it. And yet, how often do we hear about the horrors inflicted upon the Native Americans by themselves, tribe to tribe, intertribal horrors? I mean, the noble savage has long been exploded as a myth. We do know that one tribe captured the other, skinned them alive, raped their women, tortured them until they were dead, skinned them, threw them out in the snow without skin. Did you read about that in your little book about how man treated man, or man's inhumanity to man? The point is that man's inhumanity to man is not limited to a particular race. It can be found in all races. And today I'd like to spend a little time talking about man's humanity rather than man's inhumanity, because we are now suffering through the inhumanity of lies. We can take the obvious. We have one of the coldest early winters on record, yet the big liar, Al Gorleone, the head of the Gorleone crime syndicate, in my opinion, continues to get away with murder because the drug addicts on MSNBC, the drugged-up newscasters, tell you, "Oh, it's very cold. In Idaho, the lava lose the potato. It's really cold." Then they don't make the next step. Therefore, hello, can we question global warming? No, because they're brainwashed little people. The Lilliputians in education, the Lilliputians in the media. Let us go to the low. Let us play a little of the low music to capture everybody. Follow the bouncing mortadella. Everybody sing.
Everybody shiver it and
everybody sing. Amazing how cultures come to this country and how some contribute and some don't. You think about it. You think of all of the waves of immigrants into America and what they've contributed and what they haven't contributed. Think about it. Just think about it. Think about it before you open your pie hole. Think about it before you start putting down Columbus. Think about it before you teach your children more rat trap poison and put them on drugs, you. Play the music before I really lose it here. I don't want to lose it today. I want to stay calm. Now, Columbus is being slammed by the vermin in the media and the vermin in the news and the vermin in the in the classrooms. But I want to talk about another more fundamental question on the Savage Nation today. We hear that the Native American was the first inhabitant of the North American continent. I mean, that's the common knowledge, that Columbus came and discovered America, and soon thereafter the other explorers came and exploited the sacred Native Americans. Now, there's no greater, there's no talk show host in America who knows more and respects more the Native American culture than I. Remember, in 1972, I was so enraptured by Native American culture that I studied for years and published the great book, Earth Medicine, Earth Foods, which is still in print somewhat 40 years later. I don't need anyone to tell me what I've done and what I didn't do. Half the people who criticized me weren't alive yet. But the fact of the matter is, I certainly respect Native American intelligence and wisdom. That does not mean that there were not evil people in the Native American communities, horrible people on the order of some of the worst that you've ever seen. The point I'm making is a little different, though. Were the Native Americans the first to inhabit North America is the question. The answer is probably not. I remember in 1996, this has been buried, but I remembered it, and I'm going to use it today. In 1996, there was an 8,400-year-old skeleton found in Washington State that was named afterwards Kennewick Man. Discovered near Kennewick, Washington, in July of 1996. The skeleton was identified by scientists as approximately being, as I say, 9,000 years old. Immediately, five northwestern tribes invoked their right under NAGPRA, the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, to immediately rebury him in accordance with their religious traditions. At the same time, archaeologists filed suit to prevent the burial of these skeletons, arguing that the skeleton is not a tribal ancestor and can shed new light on the earliest inhabitants of North America. And so Kennewick Man became the center of a debate between science and religion in which both sides sought the protection of government and the law. I want you to understand that it turns out that the discovery of this ancient skeleton suggests that the earliest inhabitants of North America may have been Caucasian, And you say, well, what does that have to do with anything? I'll let you decide what it has to do with anything. That's what I'll let you do. You could decide what it has to do with anything, if anything. North American claims that they owned it and they wanted to bury it. They didn't want it studied. Archaeologists said, wait a minute. We're going to lose the opportunity to study Kennewick Man further. And so, as I said, they filed suit against the Corps of Engineers to block the transfer of this newly discovered skeleton to the tribes. And the fact of the matter is, some did study it. They did study it, and they quickly discovered the following. They discovered that the skeleton was Caucasian. Many anthropologists immediately said that it was a skeleton that was of Caucasian origin. Another anthropologist said it shows some traits that are more commonly encountered in material from the eastern United States or even of European origin, while certain other diagnostic traits cannot presently be determined. And so, therefore, ladies and gentlemen, before you throw away all of history for political correctness and move into communist China in your mind, understand that a lot of what you are hearing on the media, in your schools, are absolute lies being taught in order to debase the European American and to debase Europeans in general. And frankly, I'm not going to take it anymore. I'm a trained scientist. I'm not going to take this rubbish from anybody. I'll be right back. It's the Savage Nation.
Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
It's not a college class. It's AM talk radio. That's why I'm reluctant to. It's not like I'm such a smart guy. Just I'm older and I've read a lot of this stuff. and I've studied revolutions, and I know who these radicals are because I met them in the 60s, and here they are now inside the White House. And what you don't understand is the danger you're in, because these loudmouth louts from Harvard, if they were to have their way, will introduce a decapitating revolution in this country. It will decapitate business. It will decapitate the church. It will decapitate the normal family. It will decapitate your very freedoms themselves. What you can't understand, though, is that things are not as black and white as you may think. Many of you can't follow this, and not because you're not smart enough. It's because the lack of sophistication of the American voter is almost overwhelmingly impossible to comprehend compared to the average European who knows a lot more about the spectra, for example, of socialism. We haven't any idea. We're so dumb here because of the media that you think Democrat, Republican is the whole story. There's Democrat, Republican, and Independent. The Democrat Party today is the Socialist Party USA. The Republican Party is socialism light, with a few exceptions. There is no American Party per se. Now, having said that, I want you to understand that when you say communist, I know what comes to your mind. You think of a red beret, and you think of people marching with a red banner somehow. You think of pictograms. You don't quite know what a communist is. And you don't know that some revolutionaries who were not communists were socialists who defended private property. Adolf Hitler was a socialist, National Socialist Party. I don't know how many different ways I have to say the same thing to you. Now, why am I bringing up Hitler? Isn't that offensive to say that about, I'm talking about Hitler now, in the midst of talking about Obama's czars? Well, I think it's interesting to talk about because if you study the Hitler revolution, the Nazi revolution, and if you study the Stalin revolution, and then you study the revolution of Mao Zedong, and you study the revolution of Mussolini, you come to understand we're dealing with a revolutionary administration. It can lead to no good. It can lead only to bad. Now, what you don't know is that in the beginning, the Nazi Party defended private property right from the beginning. You don't know this. Although it was the the National Socialist Party, and NSDAP, you thought was opposed to capitalism. But in its early years, it supported capitalism. How did they do it, though? Listen to this very carefully. In the early days, the Nazis said they were not anti-capitalist, but they distinguished between good capitalists and bad capitalists. And in so doing, the Nazis early on succeeded in staking out their own space in the political spectrum. They created their own space between the radical left, the SPD, and the KPD, which was critical of all forms of capitalism, and the right in Germany, which was a staunch proponent of big business. So in other words, Hitler instructed his early Reichstag delegates in 1926 to vote against the leftist-sponsored bill on the expropriation of properties. Why? He continued to defend private property. Why? Because he told his workers, Strasser and Goebbels, that he had to defend private property. It was necessary if the Nazi Party hoped to attract those who feared communism. This is how it works. Now, you've heard all this about Alinsky, Schminsky. Alinsky is a pimple on the wall of a bathhouse compared to what I'm talking to you about. Alinsky is nothing. Alinsky is dead. And these operatives from Chicago are very dangerous because although you may think that they're only after power and money, which wouldn't be so bad if they were, I would be 100% for them. If it was only about power and money, I wouldn't be spending my time on them. If I thought that Rahm Emanuel and Axelrod were only after power and money, I wouldn't care less. I'm used to that. I'm an American, and I myself like power and money. I respect it. I'm not a peasant, and I'm not a communist. But no, they're not after power and money in that regard. Within the heart of this administration, there is a core of Maoism, Marxism. They want a total and absolute reversal of everything this country has stood for. And if you think that you're going to wind up on top because you're on the bottom now, you're mistaken. If you're on the bottom now, you'll wind up with less. Because right now, the only reason you're not starving is because of the hard work of people like me. The only reason you're not starving is because my taxation is so high that people who are unlucky or lazy or whatever are able to live off the largesse in order to make enough money to live the lives we want to lead and pay half of it or more in taxes, so that people who are less fortunate or outright bums can live off our hard work. So if you take out the people like us, the very people who are being targeted by CNN, the people who listen to talk radio, who they say are mostly conservative, better educated, and more affluent than the typical listener, if you take us out and you're on the bottom, and if you think you're going to get what we have, you're mistaken. You're going to wind up with less than you have. It's only because of the mostly conservative, better educated, and more affluent listeners to talk radio that you have anything at all. And I'm directing this directly at the poor and the downtrodden in this country. Be very careful what you are fostering in this country, because it is very dangerous. And understand that the television set is your worst enemy. I want to conclude this little lesson by telling you that it's unlikely that the millions of self-interested German citizens who voted for or joined the Nazi Party in 1932 could have realized at that time that their decision would culminate first in dictatorship, then in a world war, and finally the murder of millions of innocent people between 1939 and 1945. In other words, the evil that resulted had very ordinary and rational origins, and that applied to Germany before 1933, as much as it does to the United States before 2008. I will say to you, if you voted for Obama, and if you joined the Democrats in electing this bright young man with a great voice in 2008, I don't think you realized that your decision would have resulted first in what you're feeling now and what you're seeing they're doing. Now, let's stop right there. What is he doing that's so bad? Why do I say we're moving towards a dictatorship? A, because we are. But it's worse than just moving towards a dictatorship. The man has bankrupted the economy. I keep hearing the big lie. He inherited a $1 trillion deficit from Bush. That's true. So how do you cure it? By turning it into a $3 trillion deficit the first year? Any child who goes to grade school knows that if you have borrowed too much money, you have to pay it back first before you can borrow more. So the very system that he inherited, he's destroying even further. This is the Savage Nation. I'm going to talk about Ferrari and how the company got where it is and the adversity that the original Ferrari had to overcome to create his company, and how the government never helped him and never would and never will, and how government help only kills and destroys and actually stops the development of businesses rather than starts them in a moment. But first, play the sound of the Ferrari going around a racetrack so the people know what I'm talking about. I love the sound of Ferraris in the afternoon. Play that sound one more time. I was watching CNBC while reheating a piece of chicken in the kitchen. Typical power dinner Sunday night in the house. I went to the supermarket and got a pre-cooked chicken. I got some rice and reheated it, got out some frozen peas and heated them, drank two or three beers. And I turned on CNBC at my power dinner. It was me and Teddy, you see, the kind of dinner I actually prefer, of me in front of a television with a dinner. There's a lot to be said for nobody around, incidentally. Don't underestimate the power of solitude. And I clicked on CNBC, and they were running a show on, I don't know, it was on Ferrari, the company. And what amazed me was what I learned about the Ferrari story. I knew nothing about it. It was about car maker Enzo Ferrari. Here's a man who had numerous obstacles to overcome in his life. What were they? When he was young, his father died. His brother killed in World War One. He's drafted into World War One. He gets a deadly illness on the front. He's left to die in a hospital. All the other men die. He doesn't die. He comes out. He's merely a mechanic, actually not even a mechanic at that time. His father had owned a metallurgy company, some kind of manufacturing of metals of some kind. And he has to strike out on his own. But he was always in love with racing cars. And he became a car racer. But he didn't succeed as Ferrari and build a brand called Ferrari because a welfare check came from Oprah Winfrey. He didn't succeed because he got a bailout from Bonnie Frank. Ferrari succeeded, I learned, because he struggled on his own, and he fought on his own, and he didn't let adversity defeat him. But let me tell you something else. He wasn't always a nice guy about it. He was vindictive. When he was rejected by Fiat, Ferrari swore that he would get even with them. He would get revenge. And eventually, he did. He defeated them on the racetrack. The point is that sometimes negative emotions, so-called negative emotions, hatred, rage, anger, the desire for revenge, they actually can motivate people to succeed. But today, if a young man swears revenge against someone who has slighted him, he is either drugged or taken to a psychiatrist. Do you think it would be possible for an Enzo Ferrari to succeed in Obama's America? Would his parents, if they were alive, have just told him to sit back and wait for a stimulus check? Don't you think we're destroying the motivation of the young men and women for the future by removing their motivation? Maybe the government figures it's safer to send angry young men checks and put them on drugs rather than take the risk that they might build an industry or find a cure for a disease or lead America back to its rightful place in the world. These are my thoughts about Ferrari and overcoming adversity. There was one other note from the show that stuck in my mind that I wrote down with a greasy chicken hand, and it was this. He always came out for the bell, and he never gave up from a fight. And I said, my God, this is motivational. And so I thought I'd show you how far we have fallen as a nation, because Ferrari, although he was from Italy, represented what was once commonplace in America. Maybe it was your grandfather. Maybe it was your father. Maybe it was your grandmother. Maybe it's even you, where you fought and you fought and you fought and you asked nobody for anything. And all you wanted was people to get out of your way to build what you have.
Savage.
Ferrari when it was still a Ferrari, overcoming adversity. I mean, you say Ferrari, you figure the guy was born rich and, you know, inherited the company. And it's not true. He built it from nothing, absolutely nothing. And the man was a real man. He had adversity. He overcame it. He also had a lot of desire for revenge against the Fiat family for dissing him, which I'll tell you more about it another time. Today, emotions like that, as I said to you before, anger, hate, rage, the desire to get even, those are human emotions that drive men, if they know how to channel them, into creating things. To get even is a wonderful thing. Now, we'll take your calls on the Savage Nation. New Hampshire, William, go ahead. You're on the Savage Nation.
Michael, I'm convinced that you were banned in Britain as part of a strategy that was conceived early this year, late last year, to implement the fairness in broadcasting doctrine. The strategy works like this. You look for someone, a fall guy, a villain, who has four characteristics. One, he has strongly stated opinions that can be misconstrued and misinterpreted on the floor in Congress to make him seem dangerous. Two, he has no support from the Brahmin northeastern United States conservative community. Three, he has no particular support in Congress because he's an equal opportunity commenter. If he sees bad, he comments upon it regardless of the party.
Gee, I think I know who you're talking about, William. You're a real New Englander.
Yes, indeed, sir.
You're one of the real, real New Englanders. I didn't know any of you were left.
And I think that the reason, for the characteristic of this villain is, my goodness, he was so bad that he was banned in Britain, though in fact he remains uncontrolled in the United States. Therefore, we need to deal with this guy. Therefore, we need a fairness in broadcasting. I'll tell you what.
I agree with you 100%, and that's why I've been trying to get others in the conservative media to recognize that I am the canary in the mine shaft. If they do this to me, they're going to do it to them one by one. The next one will be Glenn Beck, who copies virtually everything I do. Then it will be, who knows, whatever. You know who's going to go after. And the only one they won't touch is Rush Limbaugh, who to me is a tool of the Republican Party, and they need him. They need a Team A, Team B game playing in order to make sure that the true independent American voice is never heard. I agree with you 100%. This is a test, and they're getting away with it because of the silence of the media. But I'm not going to complain about it anymore, but William. As I said, I want to ban the ban, but I'm going to do this for you, William. Would you permit me to send you a free copy of Banned in Britain? Because that's what I'd like to do.
Oh, I'd love it. And I would comment one other thing, Michael.
William, are you retired or are you currently, what did you do as a professional? What do you do?
Among things, I worked for the U.S. Forest Service as a modeler of the climate.
Ha, 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 ha! Oh, my God. A man who actually knows what is going on. I think the snowpack is going to be quite thick in New Hampshire this year.
I can give you a quick moment about why this climate thing is totally bankrupt from a different perspective that you as a scientist will grasp instantaneously.
Please do.
This whole business is based upon one proven scientific fact, and that is what's called a statistical correlation between temperature and carbon dioxide. Now, whenever you have a mathematical correlation, there's three possible reasons. A, carbon dioxide.
Well, let me just translate that for the average listener. They are saying that the carbon dioxide is the villain because it's driving global temperatures up. You're saying that the conclusion may be faulty.
That what they have is a mathematical correlation. One goes up, the other goes up, and this is merely noted with empirical data. There are three possibilities when that occurs. One, carbon dioxide causes temperature to go up. Two, an increase in temperature causes carbon dioxide to go up. Or three, a third variable not being considered causes them each to go up independent of each other. Now, scientifically, they should be exploring each of those alternatives to see if they can prove any of the three. In fact, they have proven none of the three. But
Al Gore latched on to this carbon dioxide fallacy. His friend Obama gave him a $592 million loan to start a hybrid car company in Norway, I believe. So it's very lucrative for Al Gore. He's made a fortune on this, hasn't he? And let's not forget that Al Gore's father ran the Occidental Coal Company. So Al Gore is living on the residuals of coal income while putting down products that increase pollution and carbon dioxide.
Al Gore is, General Electric is, because they stand to produce a whole new set of technology that is in some way correspondent with this theory, and it's totally unnecessary because...
Hey, William, I want to ask you, whatever happened with acid rain? Remember 20 years ago that was threatening to wipe out all our forests? Whatever happened with that?
That is still an issue. The forests have more buffering than we had thought in much of the country. In New England,
you mean nature was able to defend itself against the increase in acidity in the clouds?
Yes, and there were all sorts of theories about how well different parts of the country could affect this buffering. It turns out that in states like Vermont, with its soil types, it can quite easily endure the acid rain. New Hampshire.
Unbelievable. Well, no, look, I am so enamored of this for a number of reasons, William, because the human body, I was taught as a child, is extremely resilient, able to fend off all sorts of invasions in ways that doctors are still amazed at. Natural remedies can be used and such. And so we're not these little flowers that can easily be wiped out by a little sneeze or whatever, any more than the earth is a little flower easily knocked out by a little extra carbon dioxide, which may in fact be caused by a sunspot, for example. And I have argued, as well as anyone else who has a seventh grade education in science, by the way, that a little extra carbon dioxide is actually good for mankind because it will increase food production rather than decreasing it. How is it that Al Gore and his moronic friends don't understand that extra carbon dioxide is actually good for the earth?
I don't know. It's part of the natural buffering process. And you mentioning sunspots, interestingly, there is a 100-year ongoing study using crude methods.
We're running out of time. William, let's do this again.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Now, I want to move on to a different topic. There was a great article in the New York Times, in the Sunday Times, called The Falling Down Professions. And it's about doctors and lawyers who wish they were not. It says that about a fifth of the associates in large law firms in any given year drop out of large law firms, and 20% of lawyers overall will suffer depression at some point in their careers. It says as of 2006, nearly 60% of doctors polled by the American College of Physician Executives said they are considered getting out of medicine because of low morale in doctors now, and nearly 70% knew someone who already had left medicine. A lot of them don't like medicine anymore because they've been turned into paper pushers. Law and medicine, we read, have always been very demanding, but they were prestigious in the past. They made good money. They had authority. They were perched atop the other professions. Everybody thought being a doctor or a lawyer was the greatest thing to be. But we realize today that they've lost their allure and their status, and it is not about money. They say that the pay is still good, people know that. But they say something is missing, say many doctors, lawyers, and career experts, and that is the old sense of purpose, of respect, of living at the center of American society, and in essence embodying its definition of what is success, that is being a doctor or a lawyer. So what is going on? Is multifaceted as to why people are feeling these things. In fact, applications to law schools and medical schools have declined from recent highs. The number of law school applicants dropped from 98,000 in 2004 to 83,000 in 2006. And that was on top of a 5% slip the year before. How about medical schools? Remember how hard it used to be to get into a medical school? In 97, there were 46,000 applicants. It's now 42,000. So what are youngsters who are intelligent doing now? Well, I guess they all want to be a web designer or something like that. Some still go into these fields because of the higher calling of the profession of being a doctor or a lawyer, and they don't care about the social cachet. They care about doing you know, good for society. But for a brief segment right now, are there any doctors or lawyers out there who wish they were not? Or are there any former doctors or lawyers who left their professions and went into something else? Now, let's start with money. Money is what we're all interested in. Do you know that associates at major New York law firms started $150,000 to $180,000 a year? That's right out of law school. Partners at the country's biggest 100 firms took home an average of $1.2 million in 06. Now, that's paltry compared to talk show hosts, but nevertheless, it's a lot for the professions other than the media. So outside of the media, they're making very good money. Many senior investment bankers, through bonuses and salaries, will average $2.25 million to $2.75 million. Doctors, whether you know it or not, vary in income tremendously. A typical physician might earn $150,000 to $300,000. A surgeon, $250,000 to $400,000. A top surgeon can earn $750,000 a year, and a superstar surgeon, $1 million or more a year. That's not really a lot of money for the kind of skill set that they have when you think about that. But something is going on. Things are going on. And what is it that's going on? Well, I don't really know what's going on. I have a feeling it's because of the control that the doctors and lawyers have lost. The lawyers have lost control of their lives in terms of the hours they have to put in. The doctors have lost control to the HMOs who make them, you know, call up a clerk to get permission to assign a wheelchair to a person with a muscular dystrophy. So anyway, the question to you is the falling down professions of lawyers or doctors. These are not my opinions. I have nothing against lawyers or doctors per se. It was a great article in the New York Times that I thought was worthy of airing on the Savage Nation today. And I'm asking you, if you're a doctor or a lawyer who wishes you were not, why not? Or what would you say to a youngster? Would you recommend that they become a doctor or a lawyer? Let's begin in the land of lawyers in New York City on WOR. Tom, welcome. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
Good.
I've been a lawyer for about 8 years now, graduated from a law school in New York. Was born and raised in New York, and my advice to a youngster who is in college or prior to college determining whether or not they'd like to be a lawyer, my advice to them would be to go a different route. And it boils down, in my opinion, to or my experience, I should say, is it's not what I thought it was going to be when I entered college and entered law school. The money is good. I'd rather not say where I'm employed, but I do work.
No, I understand. Well, what is it about law that grates you, makes you depressed, frankly? It just doesn't make you happy.
Well, quite frankly, I'm a litigator, and I specialize in commercial litigation as well as plaintiffs' personal injury work, which you routinely call slip and fall lawyers.
All right, whatever. Forget what I say in my characterizations. You know, we all use lawyers whether we like them or not. But the fact of the matter is there's something in the profession you don't like, and what is it?
It's just a game. It's just a big game. It's whoever has the best poker face wins, especially with personal injury litigation. It's not what you know, it's who you know.
All right, in other words, you're right. In other words, what system, like what judge system you're in or whatever. But, I was shocked to read about 10 years ago that justice and law are not one and the same. In fact, justice has nothing to do with the law. That's fundamentally, you probably went in as a kid thinking that you were going to bring justice to issues, right?
I thought for certain I was going to do right by clients and remedy wrongs that were done to my clients. And at the end of the day, some clients are happy, other clients are not happy, and sometimes it's outside of my control. I do what I do.
In other words, cases get decided for reasons other than justice.
The time cases get decided is sometimes because the judge and the attorney know each other very, very well. Cases get decided.
I once had an arbitration in New York City many, many years ago before I was in radio. I hired some shyster lawyer in New York, cost me a lot of money, which I really had to scrape together. And during the break, I happened to be in the stall in the bathroom, and the lawyer I hired didn't know I was in there. You know what's coming, don't you? He went in the bathroom. I overheard him talking to the opposing attorney, and they worked a deal out on my behalf. Can you believe this? Isn't that what you're talking about?
Yes, I can believe that because it happened.
I was in an arbitration against a corrupt vitamin company from Long Island at the time. They should be visited upon the fifth generation, the crooks that they were. Thanks for the call. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Continuing Dallas, Texas. John, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Dr. Savage. I'm a board-certified anesthesiologist in the Metroplex, and I have a lot of problems with my profession.
Well, wait. Now, first of all, anesthesiologists are at the top of their profession in terms of earnings. Isn't that still true?
It is true.
So what does an anesthesiologist earn in dollars, and not what you make, but generally, what's the approximate income?
$300,000 to $350,000 a year.
But what is the problem that you have with your specialty, or is it with the field of medicine in general?
Well, first about my specialty, I have unqualified nurses who try to legislate that they can do the same job as I can. I have government regulations which every day put more separation between me and my patient's relationship. To deal with socialistic colleagues who want to usher in an era of Obama politics, which will destroy our medicine.
So in other words, you're saying you're no longer a doctor. In essence, they're turning you into something less than the doctor in the room, the bureaucrat. It's very much like a soft communism. That's what you're really saying, because when Mao Zedong took over China, he took the surgeons out of the surgery. He put them in the laundry room if he didn't shoot them, and he took untrained laundresses and put them in the surgery, and he said, you do the surgery. And then if they said they couldn't, he said, you're a counter-revolutionary, and he had them shot. That's more or less what's happening in America, isn't it?
That's exactly what's happening with these nurses. And furthermore, what's happening is we have the socialized government using these mid-level professionals to try to take out the doctors through class warfare and jealousy. They look up to us. They want to tear us down to regulations. They want to make everyone the lowest common denominator.
Isn't that terrible? It's awful. And, of course, the patient is at risk as a result of that, of using ignoramuses. You mean they're making decisions as to what kind of anesthesia to give and in what dose?
Now, nurse anesthetists work underneath anesthesiologists in a beautiful model, but some of them want to fight for independence when they are nowhere near as qualified.
And I get it. So the nurse practitioner now wants to become an anesthesiologist.
Basically, yes, sir.
Okay, and the HMOs would like that because they can pay them less than they pay you.
They would love it, and it's a perfect class warfare. Who wants to fight against nurses or when you have the big bad doctors to go against? It's really
terrible. Oh, my God. So it's the socialized medicine that's killing the medical field.
It is, and it's not about the money. I do really well. I want to be one-on-one with my patients. I don't want some joker from above or below telling me how to treat my patients. I want to be able to take my patient, treat them one-on-one, and have a close relationship. But because of the bureaucrats, I can't do that.
I hear you, my friend. Thanks. This is a very enlightening topic, but we're finding out that 60% of doctors polled said they had considered getting out of medicine because of low morale. Can you hear this? And lawyers in big firms, 20%, a fifth of them drop out of the law, legal profession. And it's not about money. It's about other things. So I'm just, for another few minutes, for young people who are listening who are trying to decide whether to be a doctor or a lawyer, an Indian chief, I've had lawyers or doctors call and explain what we're talking about here. Thus far, we heard one lawyer call who said that he's disenchanted because justice and the law are not one and the same. So if you're an idealist, don't go into the legal profession. And we just had a doctor who called who said that he doesn't have the authority to be the doctor he's trained to be. They're trying to give it to people with almost no training whatsoever to save money. Los Angeles, Jack, next up. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Mike. Great to talk to you and great to talk to our radio host who actually has a few degrees there, just a different level of conversation.
Thank you.
Listeners as well. But I'm 28. I recently graduated from a top 25 law school, full scholarship. Advice that I would give to anybody who's considering going into law school is not necessarily to dissuade them from going to law school, but look at the percentages of those who decide to take that law degree and go into business and use it so that you can protect yourself from all the damn avaricious other flipping attorneys that are going to come after you for
You mean to protect you from the John Edwards in the legal profession?
You need that. Oh, good Lord. Don't get me started on MedMal, Mike. That's it's a disgrace.
I don't understand how this issue of his having made his fortune through fraud.
You're going to be hard-pressed to find any law school where idealism is anything other than pure socialism. You're either in it for the money, you're going for the very top law firms. I think the quality of life stinks per hour. You're not making that much if for your first 2-3 years, quite frankly. And if you want to be an idealist and you're conservative, don't go to law school, my friend, unless you use that law degree to go into another area, which is exactly what I'm
doing. Wait, I want to pause right here because I think getting a law degree is actually a very good thing for mental training. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Definitely, definitely. I was.
I have a very wealthy friend who said to me that just getting a law degree, not necessarily passing the bar, is an excellent way to keep the mind sharp, exercise it. And if you're going to go into another field, having a law degree is always a good background for that reason alone, that you've trained your mind to be focused and logical.
No, it's a great way to train the mind, quite frankly. I went to a large public school here in Los Angeles, starts with a UC, and I was bored.
Well, hail, I went to UC Berkeley, so I'm a proud graduate of one of the greatest university systems in the world, and it certainly was when I went there many years ago. I can't say it has collapsed completely. It's still probably pretty good.
Yeah, no, I went there for undergrad, and quite frankly, it wasn't that difficult. I was really taken aback in my undergraduate training, but the legal training is something completely different. I would definitely recommend for any youngsters to go, but with the qualification that if you really do want to practice law, understand exactly what it is that you're doing. That's why you have so many people who ultimately decide they're going to become professors. Anybody with a whit of sense for quality of life, the hours stink, Mike. It's horrible.
Yeah.
I would never.
What is it? 80 hours a week is pretty standard, or more for a young law graduate?
Yeah. Well, hey, if you don't come in on Saturday, don't bother coming in on Sunday. Quite frankly, and at the end of the day, though.
You know, but wait. Let me pause there. You know, Jack, I learned from business people many years ago, everyone in business works 6 days a week today. Anyone who really runs their own business is working 24/7 one way or the other. They're rarely off. If you're running your own business, you're never off. So I don't think that's the issue. I think it's the type of hours that you're putting in where you're running a clock all the time. That can get to you, right?
No, for those that are beginning in large law firms which are roughly, it's the top third of a class, and I would say the top 25 or so law schools for your large markets, California, New York. You're doing strictly research to a great extent. All that research is going to go to benefit somebody else. They're going to take credit for it, and you're pretty much out of
luck. Right. Well, it's like an assistant professor or a graduate student with a PhD who does the research for the professor who takes all the laurels. There's nothing new in that. It also sharpens your mind in the first few years, but it's a question of, are people prepared for that kind of system? I don't know. So we've talked a little bit about law and medicine, and yet nobody, you want to go back to politics? It's right out of Balzac. Behind every great fortune, at least in France at the time, there was a great crime. Edward's fortune is built upon the great crime of lying to Ozark juries. You ever watch liberals go into Chinese restaurants or any Asian restaurant, particularly Thai restaurants? They put their hands together and they bow. Or if they ask for water or a napkin, they ask 50 times and say thank you 5,000 times. Oh, thank you. Oh, they're always so deferential. What are you thanking them for a napkin for? You're in their restaurant. They have to give you a napkin. Why are you thanking them for a glass of water? They're required to give you a glass of water. Have you ever seen liberals when the food comes? Oh, thank you, man. Thank you. Thank you. Just why? And that's like Obama in China. Obama bowing down to the emperor's fourth son. Same thing. It's just liberalism. It's a disconnect from reality.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
The teaching of Buddha under the way of practical attainment. Here's another one. Tell me whether this applies to you. It doesn't matter what your religion is. Listen to this one. A man who chases after fame and wealth and love affairs is like a child who licks honey from the blade of a knife. While he is tasting the sweetness of honey, he has to risk hurting his tongue. He is like a man who carries a torch against the strong wind. The flame will surely burn his hands and face. People love their egoistic comfort, which is a love of fame and praise. But fame and praise are like incense that consumes itself and soon disappears. If people chase after honors and public acclaim and leave the way of truth, they are in serious danger and will soon have cause for regret. It's beautiful poetry, I got to tell you that, and it's universal in the sense that it crosses over to whatever your religious orientation may be. Even if you're an atheist, you can find these rules somewhat reasonable to live by, unless you don't believe in any rules at all because you're so wild and free. We understand that. We understand that people who are not religious are just wild and free, and they're so progressive in their freedom and their liberation. As George Orwell said, he said, the more people chant about their freedom and how free they are, the more loudly he hears their chains rattling. A scripture that is not read with sincerity soon becomes covered with dust. Who does that sound like? You remember the stage Bibles of the Clintons? You remember that overly large Bible that they used to use on Sundays that was made for them in Hollywood on a Hollywood set? I mean, it was like 1.5 to 2.5 times the size of an ordinary Bible. The cross was so big you couldn't miss it from 100 yards away. A scripture that is not read with sincerity soon becomes covered with dust. A house that is not fixed when it needs repairing becomes filthy. So an idle man soon becomes defiled. Why do you think each nation, each people, and each religion had these writings? What is the purpose of any of this? It's their guidances. If you were just left to your wants and to your needs and what you're moaning about, oh, I don't have this, oh, I don't have that, oh, I don't have an airplane, oh, I don't have a girlfriend, oh, I don't have 10 girlfriends, oh, I don't have a house in Aspen next to Dianne Feinstein, the war profiteer. Oh, I'm not here. Oh, I'm not invited there. You're gonna just moan and groan your whole way through life. So you have to understand that there are millions, tens of millions of people like you on the earth right now going through exactly the same moanings and groanings, and that you have to find your way out of it without taking a pill, without dosing yourself up on a bicycle ride. There's nothing wrong with taking a pill if you need it or taking a bicycle ride. Trust me on that one. But that's not the point. That shouldn't be your only way out of a problem. Man is a creature of reason. Do you understand what I'm saying to you? How do you define man? Man is an animal who reasons. I've seen that if you're a pure materialist. Let's say you don't believe in God or creator, so you're into mechanism. You say, well, we're only animals. You have an animal body. But you have to admit that we are an animal that who reasons. So therefore, if a man reasons or a man can reason, then he can think his way out of almost any problem that he puts himself in. All these problems, by the way, are temporal small problems, these wants and these needs. You know, you should, if you thought yourself into them, you could be able to think your way out of them. And so you can't do it on your own. You could try it on your own, but you're probably not going to be able to succeed. So that's when people start to turn to the scriptures, or they turn to the teachings of Buddha, or they turn to a religion, or they turn to Zen Buddhism, or they turn to what's this now? You see the people twisted up in studios all over America. What's that? Yoga. Half of them are ex-nymphomaniacs trying to control their bodies through various postures. I have sympathy for them. I understand that. To me, it all looks like a burlesque when I look into a yoga studio. I feel like I'm from another planet. I bicycle by, I look in. I mean, it looks like a burlesque to me. If you're doing yoga, why do you have to wear a costume that shows your private parts to everyone in the room? Can't you do yoga wearing something that's a little more dignified, I ask myself? I mean, if it's purely for the spirit, to get control of the spirit, what are they wearing? A show-all pair of tights, and they're on their hands and knees. I just ask myself if it's what they say it is. So you have to find the answer somewhere else than in your own head. In other words, yes, we are creatures and we are animals that reason, so we can use reason to get out of any hole that we find ourselves in. But we don't have to write the scripture to get us out of that hole. Let's go to the people who thought this through like 10,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago, 1,000 years ago. We don't need some shyster who was on Oprah to get us out of it. He probably stole it from one of these books anyway and repackaged it. You may as well go back to the original guys who wrote this stuff. To conquer oneself is a greater victory than to conquer thousands in a battle. Think about that one. I can never understand that one. If a man's pointing a gun at you, I really don't have time for that one. Or if a man wants to do you harm, let's put it to you that way. I mean, still sleep with the doors locked and the alarm on and the guns loaded with the dog's ears. I don't trust that much in it, you know. Now, here's the last one of this preachy stuff today. This is from the teaching of Buddha. And the reason I'm reading it is not because I'm a Buddhist, but because the poor people of Burma are. And so here's another one of the practical guides that perhaps one of them read. The duty of a ruler is to protect his people. The duty of a ruler is to protect his people. Many of us would say he is. Okay. He is the parent of his people and he protects them by his laws. Well, when he says children's learn, we start to wonder what kind of parent he might be. He must raise his people, like parents raise their children, giving a dry cloth to replace a wet one without waiting for the child to cry. In like manner, the ruler must remove suffering and bestow happiness without waiting for people to complain. Indeed, his ruling is not perfect until his people abide in peace. They are his country's treasure. I love that one. The people are a nation's treasure. You hear what I'm saying to you? We are the treasure of America. You and I are the treasure of America, not the senators, not the congressmen, not the media pimps. We are the treasure of America. So they go and they say, therefore, a wise ruler is always thinking of his people and does not forget them even for a moment. Wouldn't you like to believe that? Wouldn't you like to wake up or go to sleep knowing that your wise rulers are always thinking of you and doesn't forget you for a moment other than how to deceive you and to fleece you? He thinks of their hardships and plans for their prosperity. To rule wisely, he must be advised about everything, about water, about drought, about storm, about rain. He must know about crops, the chances for a good harvest, people's comforts and their sorrows. You see that one? To be in a position to rightly award, punish, or praise, he must be thoroughly informed as to the guilt of bad men and the merits of good men. It's an interesting thing about rulers in here. And I don't want to read anymore because I think you got the picture. And that's why I've touched on various religious books. Doesn't mean you have to become the person. But just as I can read Buddhism, I don't have to be a Buddhist. I don't have to say I'm a Buddhist trapped in an American's body. You don't have to become a Buddhist to read the Buddhist tractates. You don't have to shift religions just to read the other religion's books. You don't have to say now I'm trapped in the wrong religion. You were born in a religion. That's the religion that's right for you. It's genetic. It's part of your genetic code. Your parents were that religion, and going back unto how many generations was that your religion? It's in your genetic code. It's encoded within your mind and your psyche. And you're never going to find peace in another religion. Never. Never. You're always going to be confused. You may find temporary peace by saying, oh, I am a Buddhist. You ever seen these Americans walking around? They don't even know what Buddhism means. They use it as a form of ego pride. To say. They're trying to show they're different than you, better than you, that they've evolved from, let's say, Catholicism into Buddhism. Now, the first teaching of Buddhism would tell you that you can't use a religion as a matter of pride, as the Iranian-Persian pimp did. He used his religion as a matter of pride. He was misusing his own religion. He was misusing his own religion by bashing us over the head with it, over the heads with it, and saying, the world will not be peaceful till you all accept my religion. Well, to me, that's the mark of a person who doesn't even understand his own religion. Can't pick up your religious book and say, you must be like me, and you must follow my religion, or there'll be no peace on earth. You're abusing your religious teachings. It's the opposite of your religion to do that. I'm a guy who likes museums. I don't go that often. I don't have the time. But when I do, I love to spend hours and hours walking through the museum. But what I'm saying is, think about this if you're a liberal and you don't know what's going on around you. You know, you just want to be nice to everyone and get along. You believe in live and let live, which we all do. Haven't you come to understand that your enemy is your sworn enemy who doesn't just want to live amongst you? He wants to kill you unless you practice life his way. That would mean all of the statues going back to Greek times would be destroyed by these barbarians. Do I have to spell out for you what you are facing unless you join the battle? And that means join the battle mentally at first. At least mentally join the battle. Everything that you love as a liberal would be gone from you. I'm trying to make this as real for you as I can. I'll be right back. It's the Savage Nation.
Savage.
You go to plays anymore? Like, so stupid with television. Why would you go to a play with television? What's the, you know, that's culture because it's in a theater with bad seats and you actually hear people coughing. That makes it theater. That makes it like higher art than television. If I'm home, let's talk about that for 1 minute since we're talking somewhat about what's art, what's not art, what's poetry, what's not poetry in an age of a collapsed civilization where everybody can call themselves an artist or a poet. What is the difference? If you sit home and watch a movie at home, and it's a very well-done movie, let's say, or you go to theater, you're going to watch Don Giovanni tonight at the Metropolitan Opera, how many times can audiences watch Don Giovanni at an opera house? The same plot over and over again. Why are they going to see Don Giovanni? I'd rather watch Serpico than watch Don Giovanni. I could pause it. I can get up and go to the bathroom. I don't have to smell anyone's perfume. I don't have to sit here like a stiff, making believe I'm enjoying it over every word. Then they put in the super titles. That's in case you didn't know a word of Italian, which no one does anyway. Even the Italians couldn't understand Don Giovanni because it's from another age of Italy. Does anyone listen to the show go to opera and why? Justify opera for me. Tell me why you go to opera. Tell me. I'd like to hear it. I gave up on it 10 years ago. I stopped already. You'd go in the same stiff, boring audience, the same 6 or 10 plays, either in Italian or in German, over and over again, the same boring plots. How can you sit through that? I guess it's to meet a different class of society, people who you can rob in your industry or something like that, and sell them something outside in the lobby there. I'm not into high culture. I don't like any of it. I don't like the symphony at all. I can't stand it. I do not like symphony. Am I allowed to admit that to you? I cannot stand symphonic productions. I find them overwrought. I find them painful to sit through. It all collapsed for me when I found out what was going on in the world of music. You want to hear that now? Would you like to hear what a low-class guy I really am? How I know nothing about culture? Hey, I'll tell it to you. It happened here in San Francisco about 12 or 15 years ago. The San Francisco Symphony, which was once at least a B symphony, it's now less than an F symphony. When it was still a B symphony, decided that it didn't have enough people of color and enough women in it. It was only dead white males who could who were in there because they were the best in the area. So they decided that during tryouts, which were previously conducted behind a black curtain. In other words, let's say a violinist was trying out for the symphony. There were three judges who sat behind a black curtain. They didn't know who was playing. They listened to the violinist, you know, to the sound of the music. So the fact of the matter is, they said, all right, that number one, number two, number three, number four, the number three violinist is the best. Pull back the curtain. They didn't care whoever got it, right? So, oh, another white male. Sorry, he was the best. So they said, well, the white males are winning too many of these positions in the symphony, so we're going to take the curtain away. So now you can already see, all right, we got to make the symphony look like America. They made it look like America. You know what it sounds like? The seventh grade in PS48. Like a warm-up job. That was the end of, that was the end of music for me. Brian in Bakersfield, tell me what you like about real live opera.
Michael Savage, I have been listening to opera since I was 10 years old and earlier, and I was taught and have come to realize that opera, done well and performed by a master such as, written by a master such as Mozart or Wagner or Verdi, encapsulates the best of drama, art, and the human voice. If you look back into the history of music, you will find that the great musical instruments were designed to approximate some aspect or some...
All right, no. Look, I'm not knocking music. I didn't say that. I'm saying the opera of that I go to, the opera performances that I have seen in San Francisco, even in New York, they left me cold. I got nothing out of it. Where do you go to get great opera?
Well, I was privileged to hear the three tenors down in Miami.
Yeah, but that's kind of schmaltzy. That's, it's like, you know, it's like opera for the masses kind of thing. And again, everyone has their own taste. I went to an opera I'll never forget. It was many years ago in Italy at the Baths of Caracalla on a hot summer night. I'll never forget it as long as I live, when they brought out the white horses with the wagon on the stage. Now, that was dramatic. When I saw opera in Italy, I'm talking 30 years ago, in the Baths of Caracalla in an outdoor amphitheater, that knocked me over, okay, Brian. Could have been the drugs. I don't really know. Could have been my company as well. I have no idea. You know, I was a different person then. Now I'm a reformed personality. But today... I don't know. What opera house has anything? I don't know. Hey, different strokes for different folks. You know, I'll be liberal about it.
Well, what do I care? Socialist. Long as I got meat on the table and porn at night, what do I care about communist, schmommunist? I got that NFL. I'm for team. Who's in the World Series? Who's in the World Series? Which one? It's going to be some game. It's going to be some series. I listen to men talking. I want to really... outside an Italian restaurant outside of San Francisco. I wanted to... It's going to be some series, huh? God! Look what's going on around them. They're losing their freedom every day. Like the noose is tightening. Why do they care? They're never free anyway. They've always been in prison one way or the other. They never exercised their brains to begin with, so what's the difference if they're communists or socialists? They figure the only people who get it won't be them anyway. Remember that. The majority of people under communism only feared. They didn't actually go to the work camps. There were only a small number, a few million, who stood up to Stalin that went into the work camps. So what did it matter? That's right. The rest could stay home and swill vodka and die at 43. Now look at the daughters now. Oh, my God. Get me started on that. Look what freedom has brought to Russia. Just take a look at what's happened to Russia because of the freedom. Take a look. Look at the women, what happened to them. They lost their dignity and their... Their beauty has been lost. They come here, don't get me started. So what is freedom at the end of the day? Freedom is slavery. I mean, when you really think about it, that's what Obama believes. Freedom is slavery. He knows best. What's good for Obama is good for America. He knows what freedom is and what slavery is. And he knows that freedom is slavery. Therefore, he's going to make you free by enslaving you into his worldview. So that's why I'm talking about my dog's cataract. It's like, I don't know if it's a cataract. I haven't had it analyzed yet. I'm not depressed over it either. Nothing depresses me anymore. I'm agitated. It's different. Don't confuse agitation with depression. Don't mix everything up. Because the doctors are such pill pushers, they lead you to believe that anytime you have a feeling at all, it's like depression. Everything, every feeling you have is depression. Now, it may not be depression. It could be anger. It could be rage, which are perfectly normal human emotions until this generation of pill pushers came along. It could be something else other than depression. Don't confuse anguish with depression either. Anguish is different than depression. Shall I go down the whole list? Well, that's also too complicated for you. Because Dr. Schmuck told you you're depressed, take this pill. So you wind up watching sports and that's your whole life. So I'm anguished over the dog, that why he has a cataract instead of one of the czars. Why didn't one of the czars get a cataract instead of something? Why does my dog have to get? Who do you ever bother? He's a nice little guy. Doesn't bother anybody. Look at my dog sometimes. He's five. And I realize what a being he is and what an incredible being my dog is. Your dog, too. I know your cat. We all, when you get into this animal thing, if you're really a good person and you really like your pet, you can get into this whole philosophical thing about what they are, how do we differ from them. And, you know, we are our animal's keeper in that regard. I mean, we are our animal's keeper. They're so innocent. I mean, you ever ride around with your dog in a car and they're so happy to be with you? Like if you were taking them to a vet to euthanize them. I mean, I'm getting like dark because you have to do that sometimes. Do you realize what a heartbreak that is? People have had to do that. I mean, it rips their hearts out forever. The thing trusts you. It's like it's a last ride with a little blanket. It's okay. You'll be fine. And the next thing is a good. So they trust you implicitly. How could you ever hurt a dog? How could you do that?
Savage.